Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the generous support of the Icon Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 24, the second episode of our special series on Journal of Management Studies Classics articles in collaboration with the Journal of Management Studies. We're going to discuss an article by William Starbuck entitled Learning by Knowledge-Intensive Firms. To get the text, read about the episode, and for all other information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Ralph, and I'm coming to you from Jacksonville, Florida, in the United States.
And I'm Joe Bradley, and I'm coming from Melbourne, Florida, in the United States.
And I'm Tom Galvin, and I'm calling in from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the United States.
This is Miranda calling to you from Leamington Spa in the United Kingdom.
And I'm Bill Starbuck in Eugene, Oregon.
Welcome, everybody. Today we have a very special guest with us, Professor William Starbuck, author of the paper we're going to talk about. Welcome, Bill, and thank you for joining us. William Starbuck is a visiting professor at the University of Oregon's Lundquist College of Business after retiring as the ITT Professor of Creative Management at the Stern School of Business at New York University. Bill has held faculty positions at 20 universities and taught classes on 32 different subjects. He received his PhD from Carnegie Institute of Technology, working alongside Herb Simon, Jim March, and Dick Seyert. He has honorary degrees by Stockholm University, University of Paris, and the University of Aix-Marseille. He has written more than 170 research articles and books, and has edited 17 books on very diverse topics. This includes business topics you might expect, such as accounting, bargaining, business strategy, forecasting, decision-making, organizational design, and social revolutions. Topics you might not expect have included computer programming and simulation, human-computer interaction, learning, perception, and scientific methods. His 2006 book, The Production of Knowledge, reflects on lessons from his own academic journey and on the challenges associated with management and social science research. It's available on iBook and Kindle. He's been a professor of 5 American universities and a research fellow in Germany. He's been a visiting professor at business schools in Australia, England, France, New Zealand, Norway, and Sweden. So today we're going to discuss a paper Bill wrote in 1992 that was published in the Journal of Management Studies, Learning by Knowledge-Intensive Firms. In the paper, Dr. Starbuck defines what he means by knowledge-intensive firms, provides empirically based observations about the activities inside knowledge-intensive firms, reviews the kinds of work experts do, and explains the challenges experts have with learning. Then he describes organizational learning. Knowledge-intensive firms learn by managing training and personnel turnover and by creating physical capital, routines, organizational culture, and social capital. The final section of the paper looks at knowledge-intensive firms' long-term strategic development, including multinational expansion. Does that sound about right, Bill?
Yep.
So two other papers that are What Makes a Paper Influential and Frequently Cited that Bill wrote in 2010, and then a paper written by Kerriman, The Power of Knowledge, Learning by Knowledge-Intensive Firms, which is a summary and kind of extension of Bill's article. How did the work come about, and why did you write it, Bill?
Well, I didn't set out to write an article. In 1970, I got an invitation to go to England. My family and I all moved to London. I worked at London Business School for a year. I loved being abroad, and I was very interested in spending more time abroad. So I hunted around and ended up going to Berlin, Germany, which at that point was in the center of East Germany. And so we were kind of a little island in the middle of a large communist state. And I was employed by the German national government to do research. Well, the German government also owned Lufthansa Airlines, and so we could fly all over Europe, actually all over the world, essentially at no cost. And I traveled quite a lot, and I met lots of people in Europe and elsewhere. And I became quite enamored of being an international person, visiting people in different places, having friends in different places. And one of my friends turned out to be Bo Hedberg, who was in Gothenburg, Sweden at the time. And Bo telephoned me one day, and he said, how would you like to come to northern Sweden, Umeå, and be the keynote speaker at a conference about knowledge-intensive firms? I'd never heard of knowledge-intensive firms. But I said, sure, I'd like to do that, because it was a chance to go to Sweden at somebody else's expense. And as soon as we hung up the telephone, I went around all over to all my colleagues in New York and said, what is a knowledge-intensive firm? Have you ever heard of this? And all of them said, no, I never heard of such a thing. So then I decided the solution to that problem was to organize a seminar. And we had a series of speakers, people from the department, doctoral students and professors, who came in and talked about knowledge management, whatever that was. And each one of them had a different definition of knowledge, and each of them had a different idea of what to do about it. So this all left me persuaded that nobody knows what a knowledge-intensive firm is or even what knowledge is. I decided the solution to that problem was to go study some. I didn't know what exactly it meant, but I decided I would just define this as an organization that had a lot of personnel who had a great deal of education in esoteric kinds of knowledge. And for practical purposes, this meant a lot of PhDs running around. I knew of two organizations that I knew had great world renown. One was Arthur D. Little, and the other was Rand Corporation. So I called them up and said, could I come talk to you? And that's how I got into the business. As I went around, I found the people I talked with really fascinating people. They were very bright. They had all kinds of ideas. They all had ideas about what I should be trying to do. And I listened to their advice. They recommended that I talk to other people. And those recommendations led me to other companies. So in the end, I talked to about 12 knowledge-intensive firms before this conference happened. And then I went to the conference with an outline for my talk. And after the conference, the organizers wanted to produce some sort of a published record of the conference. So then I wrote a little paper summarizing my talk. A year or two later, I decided I would try to turn my little talk into a more substantive paper, and I sent that to the Journal of Management Studies because I'd been on its editorial board essentially since the journal began.
So, Bill, one of the things I think was interesting about the way you described writing the paper is not getting discouraged when you realize that you didn't, there wasn't a lot of information readily available about knowledge-intensive firms. Because when I was listening to you say, oh, yes, I accepted the offer to go speak, and then I realized nobody really knew anything about knowledge-intensive firms. And here I'm given the keynote. I just thought that was a really interesting response to the, okay, there's no information, so let's go study it.
Well, but it seems to me that that's what we're in this business about, is finding out about things we don't know anything about. I'm struck by the silliness of most academic publishing, because everybody thinks that they already know the answers to all the questions they're going to ask before they go out and gather any information. I'm a dissident against most academic research. The other thing about this is that if you have friends all around the world, you're almost certainly going to have friends who are thinking about different things than you are, because people in different parts of the world are encountering different problems. Their technologies are changing at different rates. In Sweden and a few other countries tend to be ahead of everybody else technologically, and so they tend to see problems arising from new technology before the rest of us do. And that's essentially what happened with the knowledge-intensive firms. As Sweden moved more and more out of agriculture and manufacturing and more into the delivery of, high-content services, they found themselves managing different kinds of organizations than they had before, and they decided, the professors who were involved in that, decided that they should have a conference and talk to each other about this, and what is this thing that we have? So that's what the conference was about. They too were just discovering whatever this thing was.
And kind of playing off the notion of wanting to define knowledge, I was very struck very early in the paper when one of your first statements about knowledge-intensive firms was that they may not be information-intensive. And it struck me because even today, I sense that there's a lot of conflation between how we're treating the word knowledge or knowledge as a resource versus information as a resource. And we brand a lot of – we use knowledge management, for example, for things that is largely just an interface on top of an information management system, things like that.
Yeah.
Was that true back then? Do you think it's still true now?
Well, this series of seminars I had with the faculty at New York University, everybody who came to talk had a different idea of what knowledge was or is, mm-hmm. right? And we spent a big part of every seminar debating whether their idea of what knowledge is was different from what other people thought it was. My own reaction to that was just kind of to lay down a set of rules for myself that I thought were restrictive enough that nobody would think that I was just talking about common everyday information as knowledge, like what kind of bread to buy or whatever, and that we were talking about something that would have some kind of economic value. The other thing was that at some point it had some kind of contact with a company called ADP. ADP specializes in printing payroll checks. They print payroll checks for nearly all the big corporations in America, but they don't know anything about the information that's on the checks, right? They just are processing information in vast quantities at very high speeds. But there's no knowledge in what that is. And the actual writing of a paycheck, it doesn't require anything in the way of really specialized expertise. And lots and lots of us can write a check, and we don't think of that as knowledge, especially. And now ADP obviously has some kinds of expertise that no other company has, because they've done this for a long time and they've done it very well, and so they know how to run a great big data processing operation very efficiently. But most of their work is involved in just processing information.
Did you find a lot of resistance to the separation, you know, when you made the distinction between knowledge intensity and information intensity?
Well, people who work in business schools tend to have an understanding of the differences between stocks and flows. This is terminology that economists talk about. Mm-hmm. So to think of the difference between an inventory and the flow of goods passing through that inventory, that's a common distinction. So I wasn't inventing a, kind of a new idea. I was just playing off this common idea that's prevalent in economics.
Why do you think the work became a classic? And just some of your thoughts about the significance. I know you cover a lot of that in What Makes a Paper Influential and Frequently Cited, so I refer our listeners to that paper for better detail. But I'm just kind of thinking about at the time you wrote this and how you were exploring the ideas, and this is sort of a new thing in that context. Why do you think it resonated so well with other scholars such that it was so heavily cited?
Well, nearly all of the people who are working in universities are doing some sort of empirical research where they go gather data and then they do statistical analyses and things like that. But if you actually look at what is influential in the world of research, it's not that kind of information gathering. It's mostly new ideas. It's people who write maybe a review of the literature, but see the literature in a different way than it's been seen before. So my paper, I think, had that characteristic that it happened to pick up a new topic that people hadn't thought about and to throw out a bunch of concepts and ways of thinking about that topic before the topic really became a topic. One of the things I discovered was that I published this paper in the early 1990s, and essentially nobody paid much attention to it until about 8 years later. it just gradually accumulated more and more attention over time. But it wasn't like it popped out of the box and everybody said, oh, this is interesting and exciting. Instead, the world changed. I was probably about 8, maybe 15 years ahead of the rest of the world in paying attention to a phenomenon that eventually everybody began paying attention to. All kinds of businesses all around the world began trying to make money out of expertise. But that wasn't the case in the early 1990s. I was early on the ground with a topic. Now, of course, there's a risk in that. You go out to study something, you pick up a topic that nobody studied before, it might turn out to be that nobody ever does get interested in the topic, and you spent time not getting anywhere. I find just the process of going out and gathering information about what's going on in the world in itself a pretty interesting thing. And I found the people that I interviewed in these companies were really interesting people, quite unlike the ones I knew at home. A couple of examples. One of the men I talked to explained to me that he had been trying to design computer hardware in a company that basically did not do computer hardware. He was designing computer hardware because he thought the U.S. military needed computers that were better than anything that was actually available on the commercial market, and that by designing new computers, especially for the Defense Department, he could produce an advantage for them. But the managers of his company, that was the RAND Corporation, decided that the RAND Corporation was should not be in the computer business. And I don't know all the details of why they made that decision, but they just said RAND Corporation should be delivering services, not hardware. Well, this man decided that his client, you see, he cared more about his client than he did about his company. He cared more about his client than he did about his career. And that was a characteristic that you don't see very often in employees. But on the other hand, it's a characteristic that might happen with somebody who's a specialized expert, who's been working with one client for a number of years and feels that that client is very important. So this man called up the Defense Department. He got an appointment. He went there, and according to him, he spent 15 minutes making a presentation, and the people he presented to said, well, how about we give you $10 million to get started with a new organization? He then went back to Los Angeles, and he went to USC and UCLA, and he said to them, how would you like it if I came with my $10 million and we start a new organization as part of your university? Well, of course, they were both very interested. But there was some debate about where would it be located. He said, there's no debate. I want it on the beach. He said, well, we don't have campus on the beach. He said, well, you're going to have something on the beach now. And so he built a new organization on the beach just south of L.A. and started this company that makes computer hardware for the Defense Department.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Where when you're talking about expertise and the knowledge the experts have, it does seem to me that a lot of times that who they work for and you know what the business dynamics are is less important to them than the knowledge they're pursuing or their client. So that even though that's kind of it's an exceptional example, you do see that periodically, I think, amongst experts.
Sure. Yeah.
So the other thing I thought was really interesting about your description of writing the article was, and I have to be careful how I say this so I don't come across too critical of journals, but I thought it was very refreshing in business writing because you do see a lot of that statistical this and the T-squared analysis that of the data and surveys and those kinds of things. And so what struck me immediately, first of all, is that very interesting preamble about the garden company that didn't really care about how things flow through the production shop because that's not where their focus was, But second of all, the idea that you went to actually go speak to people and they guided you in many ways through the research, right? Through the anecdotes that they related and the things they wanted to talk about. And so my comment or just observation, which I'd like to get you to react to, is you don't see a lot of that stuff in business journals that I shall not name because I don't want to be too critical today. So that's what, as a qualitative researcher, that's what I found very interesting. What's your perspective on that?
A serious illness has infected social science research. And my most recent publications have dealt with this. We have an article that will appear in March in one of the Academy of Management periodicals, which makes a radical proposal. A radical proposal is that researchers should stop lying about what they do. By and large, the things that are being published in management journals and sociology journals and psychology journals and to some extent economics journals are simply not credible. Researchers are claiming to get 90% of their hypotheses correct. Now, you can't study a subject that is worth studying and be right 90% of the time. Research is supposed to be about things you don't already know. And if you already know everything there is to know about a subject, you shouldn't be doing it for research. Well, of course, what's going on is that what the researchers are saying in their articles is not what they're really doing. They're getting data, they're doing statistical analyses, and then they're inventing hypotheses afterward. So they are, in fact, lying in their articles about what they did. There are other kinds of lying that go on. They'll do 15 or 20 statistical analyses and then only report one, the one that looks best. Well, that is unfortunately a very sad story. Or they'll try out 12 different variables and only report three or four of them, another kind of falsehood. As a dissident to this kind of stuff, I gave up on it many years ago. I used to teach statistics. And in the late 1960s, I read an article that convinced me that the use of statistical analysis as it was then being taught by me and others was utter nonsense. And we shouldn't be doing it. So I stopped. Anyway, what we really need is some more kind of down-to-earth honesty between people. The trouble is, of course, our doctoral students come in wanting a secure job. They want a career. They want to know that once they finish this program, they can go get a job. They're going to get paid $100,000 or $150,000 a year. And they're going to be all set up for life. And that's practical alternative for them right now. But I don't think that it's a good alternative for our world. We really have to get away from this careerist-oriented thing. The universities are feeding this by telling people that they must publish in the top journals, that they must publish so many articles per year, even if they don't have anything to say. People are being discouraged from spending a long time studying something in some detail, and they're also being discouraged from studying things that are kind of new and innovative. How's that?
It's nice to hear.
What did you ask for?
No, it's actually exactly what I asked for because I'm kind of new, and so I always wonder, am I seeing this the right way? And so it's really good perspective because it confirms a lot of the stuff that I've thought myself about the kind of research that's being done. So I don't have the credibility you do, but it is interesting that perspective. And I'm looking forward to that paper coming out because I have heard that same criticism in the social sciences where people basically, they go hunting for particular, correlations. So we do want to focus more on your paper than the defects of social science in general.
Well, one more thought.
Yes.
About a year ago, a doctoral student came up to me in the hallway and kind of whispered to me, she said, I think my doctoral supervisor has given me some really bad advice, and I want to know if this is right. She said, my supervisor said I should formulate hypotheses that are only so vague in general that no matter what I find out, my hypotheses will be correct.
Wow.
That's a ludicrous characterization of what research is about, right?
Wow. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's nice you had that intuition that, you know, this just doesn't sound right.
I find this discussion fascinating since it took me 6 proposals to get to a proposal because we didn't know from the beginning which was the correct way to go. So I find that whole discussion fascinating to realize that, okay, so maybe that wasn't such a bad thing after all. What I was interested in is, admittedly the count was small. It was 3, but when I looked, I already knew Rand was still around and I knew ADL was still around. Yeah. I didn't realize Wachtel was still around. Not only that, but 2016 saw them, you know, shepherd some of the biggest mergers in the world. So obviously they're still around. And a lot of times when you look back at a paper, like if you look back at Good to Great, for instance, which wasn't a paper, but a book, you know, half the firms in that business, weren't there 5 years later. So it struck me, was it luck? Or if you were to think back, were there characteristics that would have allowed you to say these guys will probably be around for a long time?
Well, no, really. In a sense, all of these organizations are taking chances all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Wachtel Lipton is probably the most extreme case I studied in that they are so much superior to all of their competitors, they might just as well be in a different industry all on their own.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, they had 60 lawyers and 40 of them were partners. And we had a conversation, Marty Lipton and I, and he said their younger lawyers kept wanting to hire more lawyers mm-hmm. because they'd get new ideas and there'd be more people to share the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I thought they ought to freeze hiring and not grow at all because they were skimming the cream off the top of the milk. They were getting the very most important business-related cases in the world, and they were always getting them. They were getting the most difficult legal problems, and they were able to name any pricing that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't they just satisfied to do that and continuing to do it as best they could? Well, they have continued to expand. I last heard they were about twice as big as they were when I first was around there. And so they've kept on expanding. Rand Corporation started with this single client, the U.S. Army. Now, over time, they picked up another client, the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, they felt like they were too specialized on a pair of clients and that they ought to be doing something to diversify their budget, right? So that if mm-hmm. the Army or the Air Force decided to chop back, they wouldn't be caught out. And they then added a third leg to this, which was generalized grants from anybody. The Aerospace Corporation, who is it that was from the – you don't have any Air Force people there.
No, well, it's Navy and – we have Navy and Army.
Yeah. At one point, I was with the Air Force personnel operation, not as an employee but as a consultant advisor. And one of the problems the Air Force has is that they change personnel assignments for essentially everybody every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want people to get locked into a specialty. They want people to be their officers to have a wide variety of skills and experience. Well, that's perfectly fine, except that it doesn't work with some of the tasks that they have to perform. So there's a company called Aerospace Corporation, which manages the Air Force's satellite program. They design satellites, they launch them, they put them up in space, and they bring them back down again when their lifetime is over. And each of these satellites has about a 25-year lifespan. Well, if you have personnel with 3-year assignments, you're never going to be able to run a 25-year project. And that's just, so they created this outfit called the Aerospace Corporation, in which they employ employees for quite long periods of time. But you see how specialized they are? If the Air Force decides that they don't want any more satellites, for whatever reason they have, maybe the their president commands them to try something else. The Aerospace Corporation will really be up a creek. But, of course, they're doing a good job. And they are one of the few parts of the Air Force. They're not technically part of the Air Force. They're on a contract. But they're one of the few parts of the Air Force that actually has a long-term memory, right? Because their personnel are there long enough. So Air Force people can revert to Aerospace Corporation to remind them what was going on a few years ago or what was their predecessor doing. It's risk-taking. You know, they might not make it. They might take on a case that's a failure. But they're little businesses in general. You know, none of these are hundreds of thousands of people like General Electric. They're not broadly diversified. They're focused on a few things that they do really well.
Well, when you were talking about the Aerospace Corporation and that and satellite longevity, it reminded me of something Joe and I know very well, and that is the Navy ship construction. Generally, from, I don't want to say white piece of paper because nobody uses paper to design ships anymore, but from the initial concept designs and what we call trade-off studies to actually having something that floats that you can test, can be up to 10 years and maybe a little bit longer. Our newest aircraft carrier, I think we had 4 program managers, the top officer in charge of, mm-hmm. of shepherding the design to the construction. In the until the ship was actually floating and being tested. And one of the things I noticed as being a project officer in that system was that the shipyard, the builder was learning faster and better than we could because we had all this turnover. And when I was thinking about when you were describing the Aerospace Corporation, I was thinking, well, in the military, we have civil servants and they're supposed to be our long-term memory. But I've noticed lately that they move almost as much as the military officers do, and maybe because there's some sort of matching thing going on. But I think we are missing some things because of that lack of longevity.
There is a bit of a tension ongoing in the defense civilian community on that because of some of the same tensions that was driving the military personnel to go through a quick rotation is now being foisted upon the civilians that they need to show the same level of general capability across, get the same kind of broadening experience. So yeah, that's something that the Army is facing too.
Well, and the thing that struck me that's also very similar to the observation Bill made about the Aerospace Corporation, where they initially only had 3 levels of hierarchy, and because they were a very flat organization, and they found out it was confusing the Air Force because the Air Force had 7 levels of hierarchy, and I've seen the same thing in the shipyard situations. Shipyards I've been assigned to, not the Navy shipyards, but the contractors, the shipbuilders, because I would get these directions from headquarters. You know, you're the, as the commanding officer of the Navy, very small Navy contract. So you're the equivalent of the CEO of that shipyard. And so, it didn't bother me, but then the admirals would be coming down and they would talk directly to the CEO and I wouldn't be, the CEO and I wouldn't be involved and they wouldn't invite me. And so there's all these clashes going over about like who was at what level. I mean, it personally didn't bother me because they would generally talk to me whenever I had questions, but there were people in Washington, D.C. that bothered them like that, hey, you're that person's equivalent, and that kind of difference in hierarchy was caused conflict for people.
Contracting was supposed to make things simpler.
So they say.
Well, but this is one of the essential characteristics of a knowledge-intensive firm. Oliver Williamson wrote about hierarchies versus markets as ways to resolve things. You cannot handle these interpersonal relationships in a market. So these knowledge-intensive firms end up using hierarchies or close interpersonal relationships to manage what's going on. At A.D. Little, the highest paid people in the organization are the ones that the big corporations telephone when they have a question they want answered. You know, they want something investigated and they remember that George or Fred or whoever was a really nice guy that they dealt with before. Let's call up George and ask him to, could his company take a look at this? They don't go looking for the best expert. They go looking for someone they know that they got along well with, that they think will be sympathetic to their situation and assure them that they're going to get a high quality result.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating that it wasn't purely the knowledge, right? A little counterintuitive because you kind of look at learning and knowledge intensive firms. So I think that does bear itself out. That's a great example of how it's more to it than just the knowledge. There's that social capital that you referred to in the article.
Yes, right. I had not even seen this before. I had not seen it discussed in any textbooks or classes or whatever. This importance of a few people having good networks.
So the I was wondering, since the paper was written in 1992, basically the dawn of the internet age, but you do discuss how knowledge isn't just in people, but it can be in physical artifacts. I was wondering if you were to look now, how would the networks and the connectivity that we have now, would it change anything, or would you add anything based on that?
Well, one of my discoveries in the process of doing that first paper, and it actually came about after I had written the paper, and so I pasted something in about it later. I presented a seminar, and a man came and talked with me about afterward, and he said, you're acting as if knowledge is in people, mm-hmm. but not all knowledge is in people. Knowledge is on computer disks. Knowledge is in computer memories. Knowledge is in books. I realized, of course, he's right. A lot of knowledge is in hard form. Well, what has happened? Well, our world has gone more and more in that direction. In a later study that we did, we studied data warehouses. A data warehouse is a vast, vast, vast store of information that can be used as a basis for doing research studies. The American Express Corporation began saving every transaction of anyone who bought with something with one of their cards. They started this probably now about 30 years ago, maybe longer than that. When I looked at it, they'd been doing it for 10 years. Their database at that point was so large that they had to build specially designed high-speed computers to process the questions that they were wanting to ask. And it took 24 hours to go through the whole pile of data with one question. So you can imagine how big their database is today. Incredible mass of information there. Now, it's like Big Blue that IBM builds. It can go through and look at lots and lots of instances, specific instances, and it doesn't do this with a lot of statistical analyses or whatever. It's just looking for patterns. But that's what American Express is doing. They're looking for products that they can offer to you for sale, products that they can create that nobody is selling. It's a big database. One of the companies we looked at in that process was Victoria's Secret. You might be a little surprised to know that Victoria's Secret was way ahead of everybody else in the use of massive databases to analyze what their customers want to need. And when they went through this, they discovered that women in some parts of the world wear different colors and have different sizes than women in other parts of the world. And whereas their previous policy had been to keep one item of every size in every color in every store, they discovered that they didn't have to stock things in every store. I don't know, maybe black underwear only sells in the South and pink underwear only sells in the North or something like that. They were able to cut their inventories by more than half by just doing a simple-minded analysis of who buys what in what places. So our world has gone much more in the direction of big databases, which, the first question was about the flows of information and the what is knowledge. In this case, you see, what is happening is that as we accumulate these giant databases, and then we have computer programs that roam through those big databases trying to extract generalizations, knowledge is and information are converging toward each other, aren't they?
Yeah, it seems like it. And that's all for part one of episode 24. Thank you for listening. We hope that you're enjoying our conversation with William Starbuck as much as we are. And if you would like to find out more about these readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, we have now started a weekly newsletter highlighting the episodes, relevant management, and organizational studies events, as well as all sorts of other interesting things. You can subscribe to that with just your email on our website. The newsletter comes out every Wednesday. Meanwhile, I look forward to welcoming you back next week as we conclude our discussion of learning in knowledge-intensive firms with Bill Starbuck here on Talking About Organizations. Thank you.